Hi, this is episode 5 of the Social Theory Podcast with me, Chris Till. In this episode, I'm talking to Darren Nixon about the sociologist and social psychologist George Herbert Mead, who is perhaps best known for his theorization of how the social self is produced. That is, he kind of breaks down our sense of self into two components, the I and the me, which is a concept which has gained a lot of coverage in sociology and on some related disciplines. We actually have quite a wide-ranging discussion which takes this concept. We explore around it a little bit, talk about how we've come to understand it, but also try to apply it and think about the consequences of these kinds of insights that we get from Mead are for everyday lives and the contemporary world, and think about what Mead might have thought about social media and contemporary politics. If you'd like to get in touch, you can follow me on Twitter at Chris H. Till, and you can read more about the podcast on my blog, which is thisisnotasociology.blog. And I'll see you at the end. Hello again. So today I'm talking to Dr. Darren Nixon, who's a senior lecturer in sociology at Leeds Beckett University. And he's someone who has a special interest in the sociology of work. And he's also a good friend and colleague of mine. So hi, Darren.
Hi, Chris.
Thanks for coming to talk to me today.
Pleasure.
Good, good. So today we're talking about George Herbert Mead. And I don't consider myself an expert on Mead. Would you, Darren, or?
No, definitely not. But he's someone that at different times in my academic and student life, I've kind of come across and been really interested in.
Yeah, same, exactly. He kind of crops up. He's someone that you'll often encounter on in kind of introductory sociology courses, I think, and he does seem to come back repeatedly for very good reason, I think. So we'll be talking about him and some of his work today, and a little bit of an introduction to some of his ideas, and also what we think about it, some reflections on his work ourselves, and the kind of maybe some of the contemporary relevance. But we'll just start out with a very kind of brief bit about his biography. So he was born 1863, died 1931. He was born in Massachusetts in the United States of America, and grew up around there. And he went to Oberlin College, became a teacher. He later became a railway surveyor. Then he went back to university. He studied at Harvard with William James, who's a philosopher who had become very influential on his work. He then later went to Berlin, studied under Wilhelm Wundt, who was a kind of an influential psychologist, also had a big influence on him. And then he returned to the USA, and he ended up at Harvard University. There got to know John Dewey, someone else who would have a big influence. And he worked there for the rest of his life. He went from there to University of Chicago, where he stayed for the rest of his life and was there for 35 years, I think. Certainly that intellectual context was really influential on him. Those people he encountered and the stuff that was around at the time, which was really still quite the early days of psychology. And also the increasing influence of this particular strand of philosophy, of pragmatist philosophy, which some of those names were kind of associated with. I think maybe to get us into talking about him, we can maybe talk a bit about that and sort of introduce the general approach which is associated with, probably most strongly associated with him, which is symbolic interactionism. And so I wonder if you can you say a few words on what you understand by that concept, symbolic interactionism, Darren?
Yeah, so symbolic interactionism emerges, doesn't it, out of the work of one of Mead's students, Herbert Bloomer.
Yeah.
And so really with symbolic interactionism, what you get is a real strong focus on the individual, and the meaning or the interpretation of the social context by the individual. So with symbolic interactionism, it's very much it's a key school in, if you like, the interpretivist tradition, and puts a lot of emphasis on the social context in which action, social action takes place, in particular because it's the social context and its interpretation by the actor that is seen as the key, if you like, to understanding why people act in particular ways. So in order to understand how a given person acts in a given scenario, we have to understand how they perceive the situation in front of them. And I think that was a really powerful and interesting kind of focus, because it allowed, if you like, the investigation of perhaps some kinds of what we might call adaptations to social environments that from a different perspective might seem highly problematic or irrational. So, for example, studies of prison populations, studies of people in other kinds of total institutions, what Goffman would call total institutions. So there was a real focus on the importance of that social context, and the real intense study of that and people's understanding of it. And that's one of the things I really take as well also from that deeper kind of pragmatist tradition.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think, that's a really useful way of seeing it through that. And like you mentioned, I think you kind of sort of get to Mead sort of through Bloomer and through that symbolic interactions tradition. And I think I'm the same. That's probably there's probably commonalities in how that tends to get taught as well, like that way. But Mead does sort of slightly predate that, or it merges out of his certainly out of his influence. And so the more kind of philosophical end of that is that a kind of pragmatist approach, which is, according to my understanding as well, I'm not kind of an expert on pragmatist philosophy, but it's pragmatist because it's materialist in the sense that consciousness, which is obviously is one of the things which Mead is most kind of interested in, comes out of our engagement with the world, with the material world, with the including the material relations between people, is how I understand it. And rather than consciousness being something spiritual or kind of otherworldly. And that's a kind of, obviously, that was a big kind of shift at the time, when that certainly wasn't kind of common thinking. But I think still today that has a lot to tell us anyway, because we tend to, perhaps our default position is to think that our self, our consciousness, comes from within us, from inside us.
If in some ways perhaps even going more that way, in the sense that we live in a society where we valorize the individual and people understand themselves as individuals and want to express their specific individuality. But of course, and we can get this from Mead's work in particular, that what Mead helps us understand is how actually there is no such thing as an individual, in the sense of that the individual is a concept that can only arise from a social formation, which might be a complex thing to really get and drill down into. But Mead's fundamental point is to argue that consciousness and the mind is not an essential characteristic of humans. And we can use some nice examples of that, if you like. In fact, it's something that can only emerge in human interaction, in interactions with others. So our self becomes viewable or understandable only in social interaction, in which we understand ourselves through primarily our interactions and understandings of others.
Yes, exactly. And certainly for the people such as William James, who kind of preceded him, it was a directly kind of evolutionary process, literally influenced by Darwin, that we develop consciousness as a way of dealing with the world, and through our reflection on the world. And I think where Mead takes that kind of further is that it's not just the material world, but obviously the social relations is more what he's interested in. But it still comes out of that actually consciousness is a kind of an evolutionary response to the challenges that we face, because because we need to reflect on things in order to deal with them better.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in some ways this is whereby a mistake possibly of what we mentioned earlier, i.e. that Mead, we learn Mead through Bloomer, is that we, if you like, with symbolic interactionism, we focus very much on that kind of interpretive and the individual perspective. And maybe some of that broader objective, if you like, social reality can be under perhaps emphasized compared to what Mead would have done. I think with Mead, drawing out some differences from symbolic interaction, you do get a stronger sense of that, of the importance of the interaction between the kind of structure and agency, if you like. You do get that with symbolic interactionism, but ultimately the focus is very much on the interpretive processes of the individual, whereas with Mead you have got a much stronger kind of, or at least a stronger focus on that kind of broader material, so whereby you can make links with, for example, Marx. So I remember I was very interested in studying urban sociology and, if you like, how poverty and the experiences in the ghetto, as that was known in America, in particular in the 80s, what could be seen as adaptations to those kinds of surroundings. And it made me think a lot about, for example, Marx's concept of being determines consciousness, that material being comes before consciousness, it enables consciousness. You get that strongly in Mead, don't you? That sense of that it is the social. And to really emphasize that, I think one really, not as a student, what really fascinated me was the phenomena of feral children. Because I think that feral kids, really, kids that have grown up, for example, not in a, say, normal human, and when I say normal, I mean, you know, how we might expect in a,
socialized, yeah.
Easy, if we had my speech marks. So people who don't grow up in human societies, the kinds of behaviors they enact, so kids who have grown up with animals, so there's been a few examples of this through history, whereby they exhibit the behavior of the things they've been living with, so that human behavior is not intrinsic to humans, it's behavior we learn, if that makes sense. So if we're not brought up by humans, we're brought up by animals, then we exhibit animal-like behavior, which I think is fascinating.
It is, and I think that gets to the connects with the point you were making previously about this actual concern with the material world and the material kind of reality. And I think part of this is this really interesting position which is taken in this whole tradition which Mead is part of, which is that kind of truth isn't not kind of relative in this social constructionist kind of way, but truth is knowledge which we find, or what we consider to be truth, is knowledge which we find useful essentially for us in the given circumstances in which we're living. And that kind of speaks to the, you know, the examples you just talked about, not necessarily you know, kind of unsocialized children or any kind of any people really are constantly thinking about the nature of truth, but what they consider to be true or use or objectively existing is what they find useful. And this might come on to this later. We're talking about kind of contemporary, you know, relevance of this kind of thing. I think that speaks to our kind of present situation in various ways. You know, what we find useful in the world is related to what we actually. And that may be useful. That's where the pragmatist term comes in, I suppose. But that's not just in terms of how to go about our daily lives, but also how to, I think, construct our own identities and just live with other people. You know, they're really quite profound points.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that there are. That actually could be quite worrying. We might see some interesting examples of that in contemporary politics. Yes. I mean, it gets to the heart of what do we think is truth. But one thing also I want to say while we're on this topic about the importance of the social context was one thing I think also with Mead, and a common mistake that students tend to fall into, in my opinion, is that they either swing to structure or they swing to agency. And here we might think, well, if the self is a social product, if the self emerges, then the self is nothing but a social product, or it's only a social product. And therefore we get into this kind of, well, how do we explain change? How do we explain any difference over time? What you get with Mead is not a simple reproduction, because the self emerges in the dialogue with the social structure, with the social structure understood as other people, social norms, and so on. We can talk more about that with the I and the me. So it isn't a simple reproduction. It isn't simple, you're socialized and that's it. It's much more of it's your, and the symbolic interaction shares some of this. It's more of your relationship, your intersubjectivity with others and your relationship with that material world that shapes your understanding of it, not simply one or the other.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And I think, well, maybe we should get into that now, really, anyway. And what I think is probably Mead's most famous kind of insight, and but is really central, is central to his thought, is that kind of like relationship between the social group you're in and the interactions you have with him and the formation of an individual self and consciousness. They're absolutely intertwined. You use this term just then, they're in dialogue, which is absolutely, but and also that literally dialogue and sort of speech is a big part of that, and communication and language and those kinds of things. So the way I see this, I think, is that for Mead, there is this kind of this thing that we call the self, which itself is really an abstraction anyway, isn't it? But we talk about this, makes sense to people, myself, yourself, etc. We kind of know what that means in broad terms, but is actually kind of made up of different parts, I suppose. And principally what he calls the I and the me, these kind of two parts. The I being the sort of the reflexive bit of the self, and the me being the constructions of the self that are made in relation to interactions with others. What is it about that that is, do you think is kind of a powerful way of understanding that, or do you find that a useful way of thinking about the self sociologically?
Yeah, I think I do, because we get stuck sometimes, or often maybe in discussions of what the self is. I mean, it's possibly really interesting. We can draw some parallels with other kinds of theories here, but some of these ideas are quite difficult to cope with, in the sense of when I think of a self, the most obvious one is like a physical self. And Mead is at pains to say that self isn't a thing. It isn't located anywhere. It's a process. And when I think about that, I think about gender as a process. Gender is not something that we own. It's something that we act. It's something that we do. And the self is similar. But I think for many people, that seems difficult, because in some ways the self is embodied, in the sense, if the self reflects experience and our experience is written on the body, let's say we labour a particular job, let's say we're a coal miner, and we develop, physiological problems from that, then we can say that the self is partly experiential, at least, and therefore it does exist on the body. But his point is, it's about process. And in differentiating the two, I think there's an important point he's really trying to get at. The one is that he recognises the influence of the social structure, and if we go really deep into his thought, we'd say in creating your possibility to think. But maybe we won't go that far. We'll see. But the important point is to say that doesn't mean it tells you what to think. So the me, if you like, is that socialized kind of experiences that we have. And that can, as a man, as a lecturer, and so in the world, that experiential thing we have, and the way we're shaped by the world, if you like. But the I, and I think the I is useful, because it retains that element of, okay, I am not just the sum of the society, or I'm not just a mere reflection of it, although in deep ways I am to a degree. I still have choices about, if you like, how I respond. Although when he talks about the I, and we might come up towards this a bit more, he does talk quite a lot about impulses. So that the I is that sense that we can choose, or we have the ability to respond. And remember, this can be very quick in social interaction. So, you know, this is, we're separating it now. This is happening simultaneously. Someone in a conversation, someone may hail me in a particular way. I'm going to respond. This is happening very quickly. I'm responding to that. And so the I is the response, if you like. And so I think for me, the I and the me allow that, if you like, a kind of sense of structure and agency, rather than kind of a complex interplay of those two things, so as not to reduce us to one or t'other.
Yes, I think that makes it really clear. And I think that the two obviously aren't possible to be separated. And so I think one of the things that's always really struck me, and go back to as being always really fascinating, is this sense of which we can only, for me, we can only get a sense of ourselves through becoming being observed by others, by becoming like an object to other people. That's how we understand ourselves. And so and how we can get a sense, how we can take ourselves as an object and therefore reflect on ourselves. So we see ourselves through the kind of very influenced and kind of friends with, I think, Charles Cooley. He has this notion of the looking glass self. Yes. We see ourselves through the reflection of how others respond to us. And so in reality, I suppose there's an I and there's many different me's, you know, the different me's that are relevant in different kind of contexts. But the I as that kind of reflexive, the bit that reflects on the me's, I think it would be easy to think of that as that's almost like that's the dominant, that's the kind of the real self or the real person. But it's not, I think, again, as I understand it, because the I can only exist with having me's to reflect on, with having those objectifications. And in fact, would never develop unless you were getting that input, which is back to the unsocialized children.
Exactly. I mean, so if you're growing up in a pack of wolves, you learn the rules of the pack, and the rule of the pack might be you don't exist as an individual, you exist as the community. I mean, actually, I was reading some interesting examples, actually, of where the I and the me might become, where they might become integrated to a point whereby the me might overtake the I. And so the examples I was reading about were, for example, like in situations of a patron, I mean, a bit like actually Durkheim's altruistic suicide, whereby you would be the I would be annihilated ultimately through death, by the socialized me who is dying in honor in the country in this discourse. So yeah, absolutely, it's kind of allowing that kind of, I mean, me did talk about that kind of way of understanding the relationship, but I'm under the understanding that me thought that the I was increasingly taking precedence, that impulsive, so along possibly with the development of the individual. But on the other hand, I was thinking about this contemporarily and in debates that you'll be very familiar with. And I was wondering whether or not that is the case, whether or not actually if we can look at some examples in contemporary society, for example, social media, which we might come back to, whereby the kind of me or the socialized aspects might end up crushing the I, whereby the I becomes, you know, almost annihilated by that kind of overbearing kind of norms that are a pass through. And another thing about the looking glass that you're making, and again we might link this together, is, you know, we live in an era, so what's the implications of this, Chris, of living in an era where there's more mirrors, where a camera is everywhere? If the self becomes an object only when it is able to recognize itself, i.e. through the mirror or through the recognition of others, what does it mean to live in a society obsessed with mirrors that only has mirrors, where we're constantly watched by others?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, really interesting. And what that mainly makes me think of is, cause there's something, as you know, I teach a module on digital society, digital sociology, and something obviously we talk about some of this kind of stuff, and talk about some of the problems of social media and this kind of thing around, you know, cyberbullying and things like that. And sometimes people will say, well, you know, if you're experiencing those kinds of problems, why not just cut yourself off? Don't use it, this kind of thing. But actually, what some of the scholarship around that, which is influenced by often more by Goffman, who we won't get into, but has some similarities to me. And what some of the kind of the research around that suggests is that the problem is, as you say, if you're surrounded by these mirrors, surrounded by these representations of your me's, these kind of digital doubles or whatever. And if you can't actually access them, so if you were to cut yourself off, do you really exist, you know, as a self, because you're not getting that input? And especially if you've grown up in this context in which actually you've always had that reproduction of your that input of your that social input of your me's through social media and those kinds of forms, then what really are you if you're not getting that and you're not getting yourself? The other point is as well.
I think you're spot on. I mean, exactly. I mean, if we take Mead as his basic fundamental idea that the self emerges through the recognizing yourself in the actions of the other and being able to anticipate the response to the other. If you take that to its full extension, there becomes the self is about being recognized, isn't it? So if you don't exist on social media, the self can't exist if it isn't able to be reflected on, which explains Mead, therefore. I think what you just told me, Chris, what I've learned from you now is that Mead explains why people can't not turn off. Because if they do turn off, they don't exist, because they are needing what we might call likes or validation, in the sense of that any self needs validation. It needs other selves to compare it to understand itself via. But, and so in a world where it's mediated, increasingly socially mediated, then that self has got many more mirrors, isn't it? And therefore, we can easily think about how that might be highly problematic to grow up, and maybe that's the postmodern self.
Yeah, that's well, and again, like back to what you kind of mentioned earlier a little bit, is that the part of the problem with this, with that kind of situation, is that for many people, we like to assume that we are actually just individual and autonomous. I don't care what people think. I don't care what people think about me. Yeah. It's easy. I'm my own man, and you know, all this kind of thing. And I don't care that I don't need that validation. But actually, we all do. And what me tells us, it's not only we need it, or it's nice, or it kind of makes us feel good. It's literally fundamental to who we are as human beings. We wouldn't have human consciousness without it. On the most kind of profound level.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, it's. I mean, the long and the short of it is, it's really important, isn't it?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. That's one thing that means really interesting. Actually, going back to some of the symbolic interactionists that we said we wouldn't get so much into, but in terms of, if you like, you know, thinking about how you might construct a Facebook profile, you know, symbolic interactionists would think very much about, well, what's the nature of the social context in which a profile takes place. So that then tells us. Even though this is where symbolic interactions can be useful in shining a mead light on things in a way, because what the looking at the micro in the case of how do we construct a profile, whether it be look at me on holiday or here I am, you know, with my tan and all the rest of it, that tells us, doesn't it? That display actually tells you a lot more than what it actually tells you at first glance. It's telling you, as me, we would argue, that self is a broader reflection, at least of the individual's understanding of others' interpretation of them. So if people are putting up pictures in particular ways, it's because they think that is what they should do according to their understanding of the other.
Yes, absolutely. And this is something, you know, we do all the time. Again, it's fundamental to social life. It's not just something which is characteristic of these particular situations. Absolutely. We're always doing it all the time, and it's, you know, it's the most kind of straightforward way, I think, to explain the basics of this kind of analysis to someone who's not familiar with it, that, you know, we perform different kinds of cells in different kind of contexts, dependent on what we think is expected of us. And everyone understands that, everyone does that, we know that, we accept that. But the fact that that is actually really, really central to who we are and to our consciousness and our ability and to think about that. But I think, you know, another point that you made is that it's actually that's related to that is this ability to be able to reflect on it and critically. And again, some kind of, you know, kind of media theorists have kind of suggested that that we're kind of potentially losing some of that ability to kind of be critical and reflective, because it's not just it is very much about these fundamentals, but it goes sort of all the way up to our abilities to be reflective, critical, engaged. Whether that's on an academic level or just a general kind of social level, and it's really important, kind of all the way up from the basics of human socialization to kind of high level abstract thinking as well, I think.
Yeah, so one of the things I'm interested in when thinking about this is, for people like Mead, Mead is very interested in child development because it's part, because he wants to understand how people develop a self. And if you're going to do that, then you need to look at young people and the emerging adult and even younger through the child development stages, whereby people develop the self. You're not born the self, it emerges through social interaction. So one thing to think about that then is, how does that self change over time and through time? Mead will identify key phases in childhood whereby the self really begins to emerge. First, if you like, the identification of the self as a separate entity, being able to see the self as an object, and then being able to take the views, understand the views of the other, and if you like, act upon that. That's the key to consciousness for me, right? Your ability to understand the other and then moderate your behavior on the basis of that. So I was interested in, well, does that stay the same over time? You know, are we, for example, more in need of pleasing, if you like, that broader other when we're younger? And as we perhaps get older, we might think that as the self becomes to know itself over time, becomes maybe more happy with itself, that it might be more, if you like, or easier, more able. We might be more able in older age to express the self in ways that we might not have done from an earlier age. So I'm thinking about, of course, when we're young, we're very, very much attuned to peer pressure in this case. Whereas as we get older, maybe I'd like to think of the idea as I get older, Chris, I'm more able to kind of say what I really think, perhaps not follow social conventions. I feel like when we're around older people, we kind of let them get away with, well, you're old now, you can say what you want, almost.
Yes, that absolutely. So I think there could be something in there. And I think that this actually relates to part of Mead's analysis, which is essentially that we develop a more, I think you would agree with this, we develop a more objective sense of the self as we get older. Because, of course, if we go right back to the start of that stage, obviously, as you mentioned, at the early stages of development for Mead, we don't have a sense of self. We are just connected, particularly, and this is similar to some of Freud's analysis, just totally connected to our primary caregivers and whatever. And then we start to take on the views of the significant other, usually our parents, and what they think, and we realize, oh, they're judging me and I need to think of myself in relation to their judgments. Then we start to take on the notions of the generalized other. And that's where that kind of peer pressure thing starts to come in. We think, what do people in general think about me? And for me, that's a more sort of objective understanding. But what you're actually suggesting, I think, is pushing that further and further up, that actually up the developmental age scale. But I just wonder if actually, to kind of rehabilitate some of this from Mead, I wonder if the point you're making is related to that as well, in the sense that we develop that kind of confidence to be able to do that, not because we don't care about what other people think, but we have a more objective understanding of ourselves because we've developed all these different kind of me's. Mm. And that actually we're a bit more confident that actually, if I just say this little thing here, I'm not going to get kicked out of society. People aren't going to kind of totally shun me. They might do if I push it further.
But that's perfect though, Chris, isn't it? That's a perfect analysis, because no one's going to scold an old person, are they? But that's the point. So it does reflect a very astute understanding that I'm 84, I'm in this context. If I swear or say something outrageous, what's anyone going to do? They're not going to do anything, actually. So it's actually a very astute reading of the social context.
Mm.
Yeah, interesting.
But is this sense of this kind of this reflective, the reflective bit, the I, in the self, the I versus the kind of me, is the thinking bit, right? That's the kind of the critical reflection. And we can see for Mead, I think in his broader sort of sociology of knowledge, if you want to call it that, he would see that is at the heart of the later kind of critical reflection that we get in, you know, science and rationality and the Enlightenment and all that kind of stuff. But actually, is that true of how we really think? Is that reflective bit, is it actually critical and rational? Logical, if you like, or is it something else?
I think it's a really valid point, actually. It's a really interesting question to answer, to ask and answer. So when I go to symbolic interactionism, I'm blown away by the level of interest in the processes we go through in weighing up a situation and responding accordingly. Very, very much a very detailed analysis of how we'll do this quickly. We might also reflect in depth at other times, but in the moment, we'll be able to process information very quickly. But one critique of that is this very rationalist, that we work out what we can achieve. From Mead, we're getting, well, what does the other expect? How do we please the other, if you like, or from symbolic interactionism, how do we manipulate the other into whatever we want to achieve? Are we as good at that as this might suggest? Are we able to do that? Might we misread? And that's an interesting question to think about when we're increasingly interpreting the symbolic interaction via text, via technology, not in person. So is it possible for me to get these readings wrong? But more than that as well, where's emotion? I mean, I think it is in there in terms of me talks about impulsivity around the eye. The eye is creative, it's impulsive. So it is in there, but you wonder about whether or not we are that rational, like you said, Chris, whether we are that critical of ourselves, whether or not we might actually, whether there might be more social space. And from Mead's point of view, if we were, that wouldn't that reflect the broader society? Whatever we ultimately are, it is going to be reflected in that broader society, right?
Mm.
Yeah. Because that's what enables. But of course, once that gets going, that process gets going, we still have that internal process of the eye to move in different directions. So it's an interesting question. Very interesting question to reflect on. Not an easy answer.
But it is something to some extent which has been dealt with in more recent scholarship, particularly kind of feminist scholarship, I think, around around emotion and affect and the importance of those kinds of things in the construction of the self and in broader kind of politics and things like that as well. So I think that to some extent, that even if it's not direct, that's a kind of a sort of inner conversation and dialogue with that kind of understanding from Mead as well. But I think so. And I think I think some of that reflection that the eye does is, you know, it is a critical reflection, but it can often be emotional, you know, I suppose as well, like the way we kind of judge ourselves and, you know, and that kind of thing.
In common experience, it feels like that often we might be wanting to respond emotionally, like in the instant, like someone might, you know, our key point here is we can interpret things in different ways, right? So this is key. So we have to make a decision about how we do that. But it feels that it might be sometimes things will get us on an emotional level, whereas you do get a sense, particularly with symbolic anthracism, that we are very thoughtful. So that reflection, there might be a kind of difference between the act, and then we might reflect on it later, mightn't we? We might act in a way that we regret. I mean, we often would have a regret. I wish I hadn't done that, or I wish I hadn't said that. You know, so, and you're right, the postmodern turn does, without a doubt, bring these issues more to the fore about emotion, emotionality, and like you said, with feminism also. So I think those ideas have been picked up, haven't they, in terms of, you know, where are we? And one other interesting point to make as well about this, and a common social things that students will say, is the idea that, well, if the self is a social product, you know, where is me? Where am I in this? This feels like someone else owns me. If my ability to think is actually ultimately, if we boil it right down, comes from a social experience, who am where? I mean, that makes me only a product. It's one, I'd say, an error, erroneous way of thinking, that I'm only a social product, there is nothing else. But for me, experience is very important in as part of the process. Experience and also the ability to look into the future and imagine the impact of an act. So I think that we can maintain a sense of self without it being a sensualist self. We do that via our experience and how we make sense of our experiences. So that even though we might say the self is a social product, it doesn't mean, as I mentioned much earlier, it doesn't just mean that we are simply a reflection of where we come from. We are making sense of it also.
That's it. That, absolutely. And I think that in order to be an individual, and have an individual life, an individual kind of consciousness and individual development, you need that reflection. And you can only get that reflection, according to Mead, through society getting into you. And so your development as an individual is possible because of that. And so we can own, you know, the two are kind of intertwined. You know, we couldn't have. Like the socialized children kind of aspect, they don't have a developed individuality in the way that we would understand it, because we've not had that. And arguably, you know, older societies didn't. You know, the sociologist Norbert Elias talks about how in some much older societies, it didn't have a notion of I. It just didn't exist, you know.
Yeah, this is fascinating. Absolutely. And I think this suggests that, the fact that we can think about this both back with these concepts backwards and forwards. And for me, I suppose that's where, you know, going really back to where we started, Chris, was, you know, why is this useful for us as sociologists? Well, one reason we might say that or think about that is because it provides us with a way of understanding the self that isn't biologically essentialist, nor is it simply a reflection of social, you know, the other extreme structuralism, if you like. We are only our experiences or our background or our context. It allows, I think that's Mead's genius, maybe, is to really allow the coming together. I mean, it's amazing, really, at the time. It's actually very social oriented, isn't it? You know, the social is absolutely fundamental. Something that we might think ourselves as being intimately connected to a physical body and to our own personal life actually is very much grounded in the social, in the broader society. And I think for me, that's a really powerful thing, that general principle, which cuts across many other kinds of different ways of thinking, like we mentioned Marxism, for example, and studies, for example, of urban inequality. There's been really useful way of thinking about society for me and thinking about how we might see behaviour as adaptations and interpretations of particular, very specific contexts.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'll start to tie up, but I think I'd like to kind of end with a little bit on, again, pushing that a bit further in terms of what is what's kind of useful about this. And when I was kind of reading up for this, I found this quotation from Mead, which was in one of his writings. I've forgotten the title, but I'll put it up on the in the description, the podcast, which was more about the kind of about reform, about social reform, how we can kind of make good social change, I suppose. And this is just a brief quote. So he said, "We cannot make persons social by legislative enactment, but we can allow the essential social nature of their actions to come to expression under conditions which favour this." So I think what he's getting at here is, you know, you can't make people social, like, you know, into good citizens, I suppose he means, by just by legislation. But you need to, what you need to do is to allow their essential social nature of their actions to come to expression under these kind of good conditions for it. So you need to enable people to develop as individuals in a context where you can't kind of legislate them into kind of good behavior. It has to be reciprocal between the development of the individual and the development of the society. And this makes me think back to what we kind of mentioned right at the start, back to that very basic pragmatist point, that like the truth for people, for any people, is what's useful for them. And so you can't just say to people, this is what you've got to do, this is the way to behave, this is the best kind of situation for you, the best kind of society. If it doesn't make sense to them and their lives and their interpretations of who they are, their place in the world and that kind of thing. And back to that, I think what we started hinting at the start was this, you know, the emergence of a lot of kind of conspiracy theorizing and sort of misinformation and misunderstanding. We've seen this around, you know, we often get, you know, mocking accounts of kind of Trump supporters, but we've seen it recently with things around anti-vaccination, anti kind of mask wearing and conspiracy theories around 5G and around the coronavirus and things like this. But clearly some of that makes sense to people. It's useful for them in some way. And I think that's a really important point.
I think that's really nice and interesting. When you were speaking and you were talking about, you know, the kind of relationship between society and the individual, and, you know, kind of simply legislating could kind of fit like utilitarianism in a way, with that kind of perspective. But I suppose I was thinking about capitalism. If we live in a system, for example, one way of understanding capitalism on a very simplistic level is to say it's a dog-eat-dog world. And so, you know, if you live in a dog-eat-dog world, and you say, I said, well, don't be a dog, be a cat. Well, it's not going to work for me to be a cat because dogs eat cats. And in a dog eat dog world, I need to be a dog. And that is so I think on that level, that was how I was making sense. And that really, to me, really cuts down and goes into some of that symbolic interactionist, some of their literature, their studies of looking at how, for example, Stanford prison experiments might be an example about someone might adopt a particular persona because it makes sense to them. So if you're living in an area where drug dealing is a serious option for earning money when other options are not available or seem, and probably quite rightly, as not accessible as going to university and all the rest of it, then that becomes a viable alternative. But I suppose what the symbolic interactionist would say, rather than viewing that from afar, you need to understand how that becomes the case by understanding those people in those contexts. So going back to symbolic interactionism, that focus for me was a really fascinating insight, especially the stuff around mental asylums, people's adaptations to institutions over time, how they would you could actually understand them through an interactionist perspective that really understood the understanding of the person of that broader context.
Absolutely. And I think that we'll leave it at that, because that's a really nice, because that is central to how certainly I think me and you and lots of people understand sociology. It's got to be concerned with understanding other people, understanding the world, understanding people's vision, where they're coming from. If it's not doing that, it's not really doing something that's really worthwhile, I think. So I'd just like to say thank you very much for talking to me, Darren. It's been really fascinating, a lot of fun as well.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it, Chris. I look forward to the next time.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. So that was my discussion with Darren about George Herbert Mead. Next week, we'll move on to a very, very early sociologist, writing a long way before sociology was ever dreamt about as an academic discipline, and that is the 14th century thinker Ibn Khaldun. If you've got any feedback on the podcast, You can follow me on Twitter at Chris H. Till, and you can find my blog at thisisnotasociology.blog. The theme song is Verklik Viktig by Checky Brown, and the incidental music is Disco Stomp by Jonas78. They are both used on a Creative Commons license, and I'll see you next time.